So today's topic in the chain of dependent, liberative dependent origination is that of tranquility. And tranquility is sandwiched between between joy and happiness. So Andrea gave a talk yesterday on delight and joy. And tomorrow she'll give the talk on happiness. It would seem that she lucked out on all the happy factors. But in fact, each of these steps, one arising independent from the other, is just gets better. So I get to talk about something better than her joy. But then she's going to outdo me tomorrow with happiness. But I'll get back the following day on concentration. So we'll see where we end. So dependent arising, dependent co-arising. It's a teaching that's offered as an alternative to looking at our life through causation. We don't have to, the Buddha was very reluctant, very hesitant, or very seldom did he actually talk about the cause of things. But rather he talked about the conditions for things. And I think there's some wisdom to it. Once we talk about a cause, then we could take a lot of responsibility, the burden, it's all up to me. I have to make something happen. And then we take credit for it as well. I think one of the reasons to avoid the causal language is all the kind of painful self-referencing that goes on. And it seems like it's second nature, it seems obvious that we should take responsibility for ourselves and, you know, be the cause of our happiness and understand the causes of our suffering. But given how much the Buddha emphasized conditionality, there must be something very important about understanding that there are conditions, and our job is to put together conditions, and those conditions support and allow for something to grow and to unfold and to build from there. And one of the reasons I like this idea of conditionality is maybe in the best sense, if you're generous in how I say this, best senses of the term, it's kind of like the expression, God willing, Dharma willing. So I'm going to do something, and Dharma willing, it's kind of a willingness, kind of like openness to, if it's meant to be, if it comes to be, if it's right, if the conditions are there, then maybe it'll arise. And now that attitude could be kind of defeatist or somehow discouraging, but I find that the way of holding it is very inspiring. Because of the feeling of being open to possibility, the feeling, the sense of just not demanding, not expecting, not requiring, but just be open to how things are, how things unfold. And then also because when things do change, especially in these like things like in the unfolding of the path, then it also feels like a gift that I managed to get calm. Wow. I was not calm and now I'm calm. Wow. That's pretty cool. What a gift. I was not concentrated, now I'm concentrated. What a gift. I certainly wasn't compassionate, but for some reason now I'm compassionate. How did that happen? So it's kind of a feeling of, I was feeling of wonder and gratitude and kind of some kind of deep appreciation for this life that we live. And so in terms of the path of practice, the idea is to put together the conditions that support us. And we have some responsibility in putting the conditions in place. And then the way things unfold, the way the Dharma unfolds, does as it does. I'm pretty confident that the Dharma knows better what's supposed to happen to us than you do. We have all these ideas of what's supposed to happen. People come to retreat with expectations, what they're going to attain. They've had a good retreat last time, and they want to have the same retreat again this time. This is what it's about, getting to the same level of concentration. Or this is the retreat I'm going to get enlightened. This is the retreat I'm going to get into the 13th jhana. This is the retreat where I'm going to work through all my interpersonal issues once and for all. This is the retreat where, you know, you get the idea, right? We have an idea. And so you have plans, ideas, what's supposed to happen. And I've done that many times on retreats in my practice. And I've learned, because I had to go on a lot of retreats to learn, I'm a slow learner sometimes, to discover that things didn't work out the way I planned. And usually they worked out better. Or I don't know if better is the right word, but I like to think of the Dharma had other ideas. The Dharma knows. Or if you don't like that kind of language, your heart knows. Your thinking mind has only a very limited amount of the data. But your heart knows. Your body knows. And it might be that, and I've seen it, I've seen people who've had, for example, so-called, I don't know why we like this metaphor so much, but we like the metaphor of deep practice. It's just a metaphor. There's no depth. But anyway, it's a metaphor we use. And people with deep practice, and sometimes years, decades of practice. And then they go on some retreat, and lo and behold, they have these deep psychological issues, emotional issues that are remnant of their conditioning as children that just bloom up really big. And, the Dharma practice becomes more like therapy in best senses of the term. And then there's people who come in their first retreat and it's more dealing with their psychology and their emotions and all over. But we don't know what's happening. So I've learned to have a lot of respect for what arises, what's coming our way. But we put together the conditions. Like one of the things that's interesting is this idea of, it happens especially when people are relatively new to retreat practice, but it can happen anytime. That you're sitting, minding your own business, everything's good, and then you start having memories from your past come up. And, decades ago, memories can come. And sometimes they're forgotten memories, or kind of, not thought about memories for a long time. Some of them can be good. Some of them can be difficult. And then people will think, well, I'm supposed to be in the present moment, so this is a mistake. And then whap, get out of here. Or they hit the memories, let go of them, so they push them away. Or rather than hitting the memories, they hit themselves. You shouldn't be doing that. You should know better. No memories allowed. No past. And because we've heard this idea, let's be in the present. But I think that you know, the psyche knows, the heart knows, and sometimes the arising of memories is a very important part of the whole process that goes on, working something out, resolving something. And the trick is, though, is so it's fine to have memories come. The art of this is then don't get involved in them. And one reason not to get involved in them is as soon as you get involved in them, you've interfered with the deeper process of what needs to happen. Because there might be that once something has arisen, the work has been done. And then you don't want to get involved, but you want to stay open again for whatever's supposed to happen next. So this idea of letting go is partly so we can let this deeper process unfold more freely. That can't happen when we're gumming it up with our thoughts and activities and involvements. And then maybe it might be the memory arises again. The arising is okay. It's then the involvement that gets us kind of gummed up. So conditions, and setting the conditions in place. And I think that the conditions of being honest. I think of honesty and mindfulness as being synonymous. We're here to be honest. But what is here? What's going on? Then, you know, 12 days of honesty. Honesty in whatever way you need to be honest about yourself and what's going on, but honest about this. Being mindful of this. This is what's going on here. And that's a particular condition sets in place other things that can happen. So we're honest about our suffering. And I think one of the great things that practice can do is to make us more and more sensitive to suffering. Not so much that we feel our suffering, you know, just better, but we start seeing it more subtly. We start seeing there's actually ways in which we, maybe the mild sufferings that are maybe, or subtle stresses that we're all too willing to tolerate, all too willing to just kind of like put up with. And, you know, maybe try to be a good Buddhist and be equanimous about. Part of the wisdom and the compassion of practice is a wise intolerance to our suffering. Not kind of aversive to it, not upset about it, that kind, or angry at it, but to recognize and see it honestly, and not to kind of blindly be willing to just go along with the mental activities, the activities we do that are perpetuating that suffering. And these 12 steps of transcendent dependent origination can be seen as a path. You know, one goes to the next. And then, you know, it could be a little bit oppressive to some of you because we're giving these talks and your practice has nothing to do with what we're talking about. You know, and then it's like, gee, you know, I guess I'm not on the page, or I'm not, you know, doing it right, or something. But I think that it could also be spiral. You come back to it around and around. They are conditions for each other. They also, you know, people can jump around a little bit. And say, oh, I recognize that for me. That quality is there for me. And I don't see how it's a condition for something else. And one of the values of this kind of series of talks is to for you to become more familiar. These are valued states. And the valuing and appreciating of good states is one of the ways to feed them and grow them. So to recognize them when they're there, and when they're not there, it's okay. So tranquility. So last night was one of those nights I went home, Point on the freeway, coming and going. Family at home. It was all basically fine, the whole thing. And then I came back here, and it's really tranquil here. And it's a very peaceful place. And all of you contribute to that in a very powerful way. And I say that because I know from my own experience in retreat, it's easy to normalize it. It kind of feels like, and after a while, not even to recognize that there's anything special here. Like, actually, it's the opposite. Some of you heard the story when I went on retreat, a month-long self-retreat, and the first day of the retreat, when I was unpacking my car, the place was so quiet and peaceful and tranquil. And the last day, when I was packing my car, and being there, I looked around and, what happened? The place was so peaceful a month ago and so tranquil, and now it's just like a normal, like it's nothing, it's just like place. And I thought, well, I guess that month-long retreat was a failure. It didn't work. not responsible for every thought that goes through my mind, right? I'm just responsible what I get involved in and believe. Mm-hmm. So these thoughts got through. And then I went down to the office to check out. And when I walked into the office to talk to the people there, I couldn't speak. I was so still, so deep, or again, this metaphor, deep. So, like to find my voice again, it was like, so they say we normalize what's going on, or we don't even tune into what's going on around us because we're in turmoil. We're our whole inner drama is going on and, what's happening. But I'm pretty confident that all of you, no matter how agitated you might be, at times during the day or something, that you're much calmer, more quiet here, more tranquil than you were 3 days ago. Though you might not recognize it. Until we send you out to Safeway to get supplies. We have conditions here. The conditions are we live in silence mostly. The conditions here are we kind of follow a schedule. Conditions are that we sit and meditate and walk and meditate. The conditions are we're trying to be honest with ourselves. The conditions are greatly supported if we try to be compassionate with ourselves. And all this kind of helps kind of settle something. And what does it settle? What gets settled within us? I guess the simple thing to say is our agitation. And a hugely important part of the Dharma practice is understanding the nature of our agitation. And I appreciate, there was that agitation, now it's no longer here. I talked to a man recently who had some difficulties. And he said, when I'm thinking, I get into trouble. I'm thinking, I spin out. But when I'm mindful, I'm grounded. And he made a clear contrast between being mindful and thinking. And to understand the nature and the effect thinking has is part of the wisdom of this practice. To really kind of notice that when you start thinking a lot, the effect it has on your emotions, your mood, your energetic level. And what happens when that quiets down? What shifts and changes? What kind of power and hold do our thoughts have over our lives? When we get, the story of the Chinese painter who painted the dragon, very realistic dragon, spent a long time painting it, I guess, and then the painter stepped back to kind of take a bit, stepped back to get a sense of the whole dragon, and it was so realistic it frightened him and he ran away. So, we get involved, we get caught up in our thoughts. We make images and ideas and stories and memories and conversations. To notice the effect it had, those things can have on our agitation, our restlessness. And there's a different vantage point on retreat to see that, because you are calmer than you are calmer than usual here. So the more calm you are, the more clearly you can see the nature of agitation when it arises. And that's part of the function of retreat. So if you find yourself getting agitated on retreat, restless, or in a thought storm of something, rather than being upset by that, congratulate yourself. In the sense that now you get to see it. It's something for you to learn there. Something for you to understand about the nature of agitation, nature of being involved in thought. Not necessarily the content, but just the whole process of what's going on and how you got hooked in, and also how you can't necessarily just turn it off. Maybe you don't believe it, maybe you're a little disenchanted with it, but sometimes some of the stuff just has to, you know, the momentum is there and you have to kind of run its course a little bit. It's like if you go for a run, you know, I mean, say you go for a nice long run, but as soon as the run is over, you sit down to meditate. It would take a while before your breath got calm, because it just it takes a while physiologically. So same thing with when there's a really good thinking going on. You know, it takes a while for the energy of it to dissipate, and you can't just flip a switch. So tranquility. So one of the very, I think, useful areas of tranquility is to have a calm gaze. To have a calm gaze. What I mean by this is that in that mindfulness is a kind of a seeing of things, seeing what is, or knowing what is. That see if you can have your gaze on things be calm. Kind of be willing to look things right in the eye and, you know, I see you, and just kind of let the way you look, you might not be calm, but then you can look at your agitation. Agitation, I see you. And see if you can experiment a little bit and see if in the looking you can look in a calm way or a steady way or an unagitated way, not jumping around too much. Just kind of look. Someone gave me a story a long time ago of a monarch of a realm who wanted a painting that perfectly captured tranquility. So all the great painters of the realm made this big, all kinds of very peaceful, serene, pastoral paintings. The king said, no, none of them worked. And the ministers went all over the realm looking for someone, the painters, right? And none of them could do something that satisfied the monarch. So they were about to give up. And so finally they said, well, somebody heard, well, deep, you know, in the back country, there's this poor old farmer. Some people say, you know, she's a good painter. There's only one left. So they went and got her, and so she said, well, I'll paint something, she said. And so she painted, spent some time painting, and then there was going to be the unveiling in front of the monarch. And they took the curtain off, I guess. And it was a torrential rain waterfall. I don't know how big the painting was, but just crashing down, and you've probably seen these violent waterfalls. And they said, what? What were you thinking? This is not tranquil. And so she said, come look, come really close to the painting. See right in there, there's a little kind of rock, and the water just above the rock, you know, gets pushed to the side. And underneath there is a little ledge. Just look in there. So they got close to that painting, and sure enough, sitting in there was a little bird's nest, and a little bird just sitting there peacefully. Tranquilly. Ah, you win the prize. You did the most tranquil painting. So this idea, a little bit, where can we find a little tranquility in the middle of the agitation, the storms? And I think one of the places sometimes available is in the gaze, in the knowing, how we know it. And in order to do that, it helps a lot that we don't identify with what's happening. The identification is where we get pulled in, locked in, entangled with what is. Identifying means we define ourselves by it, we think we are it, we think we have to do something about it, we have to fix it, we have to judge it, we have to be it. We have to be our thinking. Some people are unwilling to let go of thinking because if they don't think, then who are they? Thinking is how they figure out their whole life and how they make themselves safe. They're so identified with it. Or with feelings and emotions. That's how that people negotiate their life, is through their emotions and feelings. And who would I be if I don't have my emotions? And so they hold on to them. Some people are identified strongly with their suffering, their pain. Because without that, who would they be? But in the knowing, in the gaze, it's possible to, in the gaze, to kind of, in a way, I don't know if this language works for you, but I like it, but kind of to step back from it, just take and look at it, what's happening, to know it. Don't be kind of entangled with it, just step back and see it. This is what it is, this is what's happening. This idea of stepping back in a peaceful place, a quiet place, a little bit unentangled place, and the tranquility of your gaze. And as Andrea talked about this morning, you know, just little pieces of concentration, little pieces of mindfulness or continuity. So small, you don't have to hold the gaze for a long time. In fact, if you hold the gaze for a long time, you probably get tired. But just for a moment, to look, and then do it again. Oh, look at this. And what happens, what conditions you set in place when how you know something, in the knowing, in the gaze, you're calm, you're at ease. What does it take to be calm or at ease in the knowing of what's known? So even if you're in the middle of a torrential rainfall, a waterfall, in the middle of it, there can be powerful feelings, powerful thoughts. And not to dismiss them or belittle them or to deny them, but there is a place, a little ledge in your waterfall, where you can stand and just be there in the middle, allowing it all to be, and just know it. This. I like this image in the picture, this painting, that's just a little bird. A little bird. Sometimes that's all we can find in ourselves, is a little thing, a little bird, a little. You know, birds have very little eyes, so the gaze is small. You know, so just a little bit. And sometimes it gets bigger. Sometimes the tranquility is this little point of knowing in the middle of the difficulty of the agitation we have. And sometimes the tranquility is not in the middle or not stepped up back looking, but it just holds it all. Sometimes tranquility gets really big. It just seems like it pervades everything. It's almost as if the walls and the floors and everything we see is somehow saturated with tranquility. So in this chain of the steps of transcendent dependent origination, a particular kind of tranquility they're talking about in this list is a tranquility that builds on or follows from the condition of joy. I like to think of it as sometimes well-being. That as we kind of have some kind of well-being or some kind of feeling of rightness, some feeling of more ease or rightness or okayness or feeling of safety. To different people is different things. As we feel more of this, that then we can begin to relax. The ways in which we hold ourselves defensively or aggressively or quick to blame, quick to defend, quick to, or the ways in which we are holding on for dear life to our, whatever we're holding on to our practice. When I went to practice in Burma, I was housed in this lodge. It was a one-story long building with all kinds of little, I don't know, maybe 10 rooms in it, and with a hallway that was shared by everyone in it. And when I was new there the first day or two, and didn't know what was going on or, you know, where things were or how things worked. And so I very respectfully, quietly kind of walked up to one of the other Westerners who was there, who was doing walking meditation, I think, or just doing something, and asked him, you know, something. And he kind of scowled at me. "Don't disturb my practice. Don't you see that I'm doing my practice? Of course, this is serious stuff. You know, don't interrupt my practice." I said, "Oh, I'm sorry." So I retreated. And I don't think it was a coincidence that he had that attitude. And he was the person who was most unhappy in all the months that I was there. The practice wasn't working for him, and he was like trying so hard and protective of his practice and, you know, my thing. And so anyway, all these ways in which we're held, we're tight, we're brittle, we hold on, we are tense. And so the step of tranquility is a step of relaxation, of relaxing the body, relaxing the mind. And it sort of helps a lot to feel safe, in a place that you really feel safe. And so in a place like this, we hope that the IRC, that you feel safe here. And it's nice to be reminded of that. This is a safe place. Maybe your logical mind, your thinking mind doesn't need to be reminded, but maybe your heart does. This is a safe place. These are safe people here. It's going to be hard to find 40 people like this. Last August there was a kind of a retreat here, and someone dropped their wallet downstairs. And so someone put the wallet on the lap of the Buddha downstairs. And it was there for a couple of days, I think, or a day and a half or something. And I was kind of perplexed, you know, doesn't the person who dropped the wallet realize that he's lost it? And isn't he looking around? It's right there in the community hall. And, you know, doesn't he? It was just there. No one took it. It was a safe place to let it be. Or maybe part of you can relax because this is an environment where you don't have to prove yourself or defend yourself. Or I think it's so helpful. Many people struggle under this idea they have to prove themselves or be something. Or it's enough just to be here. It's enough just to be alive and to settle in and relax. And the instructions the Buddha gave for meditation practice, one of the most common instructions at the start of meditation, or start of the process, is to experience, to breathe in and breathe out and experience the whole body And then to relax the bodily formations. Bodily formations are those sensations we have in our body that come, that are there because of how we use our minds. So if we are tense in our mind and we have tense shoulders, that's a sankhara, that's a formation. So we take all the kind of bodily, mind kind of formations and that show up in the body and try to relax it, maybe as you exhale. And so over and over again he gave this instruction, breathing in, relaxing the bodily formations, breathing out, relaxing the bodily formations. Actually, the usual translations use the word tranquil, making tranquil. So have you checked your body out enough to know if you're holding? You're tense. I find it very helpful to periodically, even when I'm kind of so-called deep and quiet and focused, is to even pull myself out of that little bit and look around and see, am I tense in any place at all? Sometimes they're kind of, I might be kind of trying a little bit, it could be very subtle, but I'm trying too hard. Or maybe I'm not trying enough, I'm kind of getting complacent. But sometimes I step back and kind of check it out, the bigger picture. Am I tense anywhere? Shoulders, the jaws, the arms, the neck, all kinds of subtle places that can be a little holding. And then Buddha talked about relaxing the mental formations, relaxing the mind. And that's partly where I get this instruction, many of you heard from me, of relaxing the thinking muscle. And so the idea being that if you're depending on how that our thinking, the process of thinking, comes along with some mental, some physical sensations. And if it's very powerful thinking, then you get a headache, right? And so it comes with that, or you feel tight in your forehead, or you feel pressure or energy or tension someplace. If it's very subtle thinking, maybe you have to have a very subtle mind to see the little stress or tension that might be there. But to notice the physicality of thinking, the physical aspects of your thinking process. So especially if you're thinking a lot and in meditation, you can't stop thinking. See if you can notice the physicality, what it feels like to be thinking. And then, see, if once you tune into that, can you relax that? The image I like for that kind of relaxation of the thinking muscle is kind of like making it kind of, it's like a lump that that then relaxes, it kind of spreads out horizontally flat, like a big, peaceful alpine lake. And it's not that it's that easy to do, but that's kind of the image I have, taking this lump of the thinking muscle and just relaxing it. And then there's, in terms of tranquility and the conditions for it, there is allowing yourself to be tranquil. And, I think some people never occurred to them. Why should you never? It's never not in their vocabulary. It's like, not in their, it never occurred to them and never had any idea that why bother? What's that about? There's all these wonderful things to do in life. In Santa Cruz, you can go surfing. So but to allow for tranquility, allow to appreciate it, to notice it there, to make space for it. Notice you are tranquil. When you sit down at a meal here at IRC, you serve yourself food and you go sit down. Allow yourself to sit with whatever tranquility is there. before you get too involved with your food. I don't know about you, but I can get pretty involved with my food, that I kind of like don't pay much attention to other things because the food is like the main entertainment of the day. But, you know, to allow for the tranquility to be there. And as there's a little bit more tranquility and tranquility, there's an art to kind of function with the tranquility or walk through the tranquility or let how you are, what you do, kind of emerge from the tranquility. So that instead of having what you do be ahead of the tranquility or outside the tranquility. So maybe what I mean by this is, for example, the bell rings for lunch and you're pretty peaceful and calm. And so you, when you get up to walk down to the dining room, you walk with the tranquility, or you walk within the tranquil state, or you stay in touch with it. You kind of allow for, make sure there's enough space for it to stay there. As opposed to, oh boy, lunch. I'm going to race down there and be the first in line. You know, if we were thinking about lunch, you know, then we forget all about tranquility because we have this really important thing going on, lunch, or whatever else might be. But to stay, you know, so in the steps of dependent co-arising, tranquility follows joy, and joy follows delight. And the delight is has something to do with evaluation. So we have a thinking about something that brings us joy and kind of certain delight and gladness. Which is lots of, you know, there are things to think about that are easy and simple. And the joy or the piti is not so much from thinking about things, and actually doesn't depend on the conditions of the world, but it is arising from within, a bubbling up of within, of our vitality, joyful vitality. It's kind of like the energies in our body are no longer contracted and held or preoccupied, but are freed up. And that freeing of our energy can bring kind of inner wellsprings of rapture, of joy. The image that's given, many of you know, is that of a lake, in my vocabulary, an alpine lake, beautiful, but a lake where there's no streams running into and it's not raining, meaning there's no input through the sense data, eyes, ears, nose, nothing's coming in, that's feeding it. But the way the lake gets fed is an underwater spring that bubbles up and flows up. So at some point, as the energy gets released and we're no longer caught up in the worlds or streams of things around us, then there can be this nice energy. But it tends to be a little bit of a thrill first. It tends to be a little more, even though it's not involving thought so much, it's kind of a mental excitation. And then when that begins to tranquilize, when that begins to relax, then we start having more tranquility. So the idea is that we at some point, it happens by, and it can happen on its own, you don't have to engineer it, but you might feel a lot of joy or well-being, certain kind of joy in practice, and then it starts to quiet down because it's to a less active place, place of tranquility. And that tranquilizing of joy is the condition for the next factor, which is happiness. So you get, you know, and each of these gets better, you know, or better in the sense of being more satisfying. We feel more, a certain kind of way, more alive, more full, more complete, more here. And it's really great, this thing about just being fully here. Fully here, just this moment. Living your moment fully. So fully that there's, you know, no room for other times and places, and in that that fullness, there's a holistic feeling of being alive. We become whole. We're not fragmented anymore. This idea of being just here, whole, present, grounded, rooted, peaceful, simple. Nothing to prove, nothing to explain, nothing to defend, nothing to have excuses for, nothing to feel inadequate about. There's no need to feel unworthy, just it's nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with it. Just like we're just here. Peaceful, tranquil. Connected, whole, just here, just this moment here. And there's this tranquility factor in my mind is closely connected to contentment. There's a contentment where we don't have to anymore be striving or trying to make something happen. Just here. It's enough just to be here. Just this moment is enough. This breath is enough. Just here. I appreciate very much your practice, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing you're doing. And if I may, I'd like to encourage you to be the good custodian of your practice. Care for your practice carefully and stay close to it. And when it seems appropriate, perhaps there's times of tranquility, either tranquility in your gaze, a calm gaze, or the tranquility of the body becomes tranquil, or tranquility of mind. And when there's some tranquility, maybe that can be partly your teacher, your support, your companion that you allow for and stay close to. And it helps you with a further relaxation, further settling, further helping the mind trust that it's okay just to be. The thinking mind doesn't have to be so active. do so much.